All right, 7:30. Thanks for coming, everyone. We'll probably have some others join, but I'm just going to be doing review, and so you're lucky to be early, and you get to do the review things. So if it's the 24th of August, I guess we should study Micah and the Danites. That's our plan anyway. And I'll remind you of the Bible Project. You can always watch that anytime you want. And where we are now is we're in that third division, and we're studying the last part. So remember there was this kind of an introduction over here, and then the major judge stories are in here, and then there's this epilogue here. But he, the guy that was talking about this, you know, the judges go from good to worse, and then in the end there's these stories, which probably occurred earlier in the book of Judges, maybe some time back over here, but they just show the moral decay and to some extent civil decay and other things. And so we'll study chapter 17 and 18 tonight and finish up next week with this very disturbing story from 19 through 21. Here's the outline in textual form. And so we're here, we're in the kind of the balancing section. So incomplete conquest covered in the beginning, and then the moral decline with, of course, the key word which appears in this section, the key phrase, there's no king in Israel. And then combined with, and everyone did right in their own eyes. All right, here's our good words here. So everybody go off mute. Let's shout these out quickly. I think we've got these pretty good. What's El or Elohim?
Ad.
Yes. And you realize that Samuel and any of those names in the Bible that end with El or begin with El have the word for God in them. So we might think of one of those tonight. Yahweh, Yah, 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 Jah. What are those words?
Jehovah.
Yeah, the I am word. Adonai.
Word.
Lord.
Yeah.
Lord.
Master.
Baal.
Lord.
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 Husband.
Lord. Husband.
Yeah, that's right.
A deity.
To a deity, right. Baal is another way. That one of those guys that has the audio Bible says it. I think it's pretty cool. He says Baal as if it's a two-syllable thing. You know, scary kind of name. Ben.
Son of.
Yeah, Benjamin or Yamin.
Son of my right hand.
Beer, another two-syllable word, maybe beer.
Well,
water, that's right. Beth?
House.
Good.
House.
L, combined words.
House of God.
Good. Bethlehem.
House of bread.
House of bread.
That's up in the story tonight. Shalom, Salem, Shiloh, a lot of those words kind of have the same root.
Peace.
Good. Abi?
Father.
Yes, or my father or father. Melech or Melchi?
King.
King.
And Melchizedek. Zedek, righteousness, king of righteousness. Negev?
South.
Good. Gilgal?
Rolling.
Bochum?
Weepers.
Good, thank you. This is great. Havoc?
Village.
Villages.
Yeah, villages, yeah. Yeah, the villages are, it really kind of means tent villages, but they maybe started that way. They weren't ended up not being tents, but he was the villages. For example, Havoth Jair, Havoth something else. And Kiriath, similarly. Kiriath or Kirjath. We're going to have, there's a bunch of those. What is it?
City.
Yes, very good. So Kirjath Jearim, I think, is going to be city of forest or something. Yeah, we'll see that tonight. Jerob Baal.
Baal contend.
Good. That was Gideon's name. Berith.
Covenant.
Covenant.
Yes, good. It was Baal Berith, Baal of the Covenant, and Lehi.
Jawbone.
Good. Yes, jawbone or cheek. That's great. All right, I really mixed this one up tonight. You'll enjoy this. I didn't go from south to north or north to south. I just scrambled them up, but you can call out the letters. We're going to start at the top. Where is Issachar?
B.
Issachar's race, B.
Yes, that's right. Flat areas where chariots do very well. That's Issachar. All right, Ephraim.
Jay.
Yes. And remember these cities. Jerusalem borders Judah and Benjamin. Bethel borders Ephraim and Benjamin. And then there's Shechem, which is on the border of Ephraim and another one, which we'll get to in a second. Simeon. Where's Simeon?
D.
I think I heard D. I hope that's right. D, absorbed in Judah. Yes, good. Reuben.
E.
Yeah, Transjordan tribe. Very good. Judah.
H.
H.
H, very good. Asher, by the sea.
F.
Yeah, I always think of that. Naphtali.
Next home of Asher.
Barak. Ian. Yes, Ian, very good up there. Zebulun. Zebulun. It's always just stuck in the middle.
It's
him.
That's good. All right. Where is Benjamin?
L.
Right there, L.
Right between. Dan?
I-N-G.
Yes, I-N-G. We'll learn about why that's so tonight, this very lesson. And Manasseh, again, two answers.
A and
C.
C. Good. West Manasseh and East Manasseh.
Yeah, A and C.
And then you're kind of down to one left for Gad. That's the Transjordan tribe, so Gad. And okay. Where is Levi?
All over the place.
Spread through cities of refuge.
Yeah, and other cities, too, that they had assigned to them in each tribe. And that's important because we're going to see a Levite who wasn't satisfied where he was in Bethlehem, and he's wandering around. And he's called a Levite of Judah. And you would almost think that he was like a priest from the tribe of Judah, but that's not it. He was a Levite assigned to one of the cities of Judah, but he started wandering. He apparently was not satisfied with whatever job, position, pay, whatever it was going on in Bethlehem. So our lesson tonight, where on this map is our lesson tonight? I mean, I know the Danites go way up here, so that's included, but where is most of the action? Can you find it? Where would it be?
Ekron? No.
So it's around there, yeah. So hint, Micah and the Danites is the name of the lesson. So it's probably down here. And the priest was from, anybody remember he was from Judah, but where in Judah? Have you read it? This wandering Levite?
Gath?
Nope.
No. Okay.
He was from Judah.
Bethlehem.
Very good. He was from Bethlehem. And Kiriath Jearim appears in here, which also is known as the Camp of Dan, which we heard about in another story before. And then the Micah lives where? He lives where? Micah lives in the... I can't read your lips.
The Pill Country.
That's good, the Pill Country of Ephraim. And so there's actually a mountain range down through here, and maybe it's over here somewhere. Those are all the areas. In fact, I put a little circle. That's kind of this. That circle includes Bethlehem, Zorah, is that it, in Eshtaol, which is where the Danites were from, the hill country of Ephraim, and then also Kiriath Jearim, which appears in the story, also known as Mahanaim Dan, or the Camp of Dan. All right, so here's a closer look. It will learn that these Danites come from this area, Zorah and Eshtaol down here. We're just guessing where is the hill country of Ephraim, where he is. You see there's kind of a mountain range here. And then Bethlehem, which is, of course, south of Jerusalem, that's where this Levite's from. So he's wandering around. He comes up at Micah's house. This is where Micah's house is. And then the Danites, of course, are on their way up here, you know, to go find their homeland. And that's why they pass through this area. Okay, this map makes it look big, but I think we're talking about an area you could hike to in about a day. You know, in all these areas, it's not that far apart. Okay. I don't see a scale on this map, but if you go back to this one, you see how it's really a small area. And this is 40 miles from here to here. So it's not very far. Okay. Let's start. There was a man from the mountains of Ephraim. Do you ever wonder why they're always called the hill country of Ephraim and not just Ephraim? Why does it always say that? And you remember, we call them the pill country because they're always difficult. And they're always arguing. We've seen that with what Gideon and Jephthah so far in the book of Judges. It seemed like there was another one that, they did help early on in the story of Ehud, I guess it was. But they seem troublesome. And I've mentioned that later they're, of course, going to be rebellious. And it will be this fellow named Jeroboam comes from Ephraim. And by the way, it was the tribe of Joshua. If I remember right. Why is it the mountains, the hill country is another translation. And in that theme of the pill country of Ephraim, where's my pointer here? Let's see. So I just want to go back briefly to Joshua's time and look at how Ephraim got their territory. Look at this text from Joshua 17. I won't read it. This part up here is describing the inheritance of Ephraim and Manasseh. You remember those two are whose sons? Who are Ephraim and Manasseh? Who's their father?
Joseph.
They're kind of the tribe of Joseph, tribes of Joseph, because Joseph got a double inheritance, those two tribes. And so he's describing here their territory, Manasseh and Ephraim and so on. So notice in verse 14, the children of Joseph, of course, that's the tribes, spoke to Joshua saying, why have you given us only one lot and one share to inherit since we are a great people? Now, y'all remember that map we just looked at. Were Ephraim and Manasseh pretty large territories on that map? You remember? Yes, they're huge, right? In fact, this description above describes a pretty large area, right? And notice they say, we're a great people, right? They point out how great they are, and the Lord has blessed us until now. Joshua does a pretty clever thing. He says, look, if you're a great people, then go clear out the place for yourself and get rid of all those people. You see what he's saying there? Go clear out a place for yourself in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you. Why are they in the mountains?
They're hiding.
Yeah, read the next verse. But the children of Joseph, that's Ephraim and Manasseh, said, the mountain country is not enough, and all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron. So why are they confined to the mountains? You pretty well see what the problem is, and that is they didn't take their land. They did not have the faith or courage or ability to, despite the fact that they say they're a great people, and Joshua throws it back in their face. He said, well, you're a great people, then take the rest of your land and don't ask for more. You see what's happening in this interchange. This is back in the book of Joshua. So anyway, so he answers them. He says, look, you are a great people, and you have great power. And so you've got these two territories, basically. You shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots or strong. So Joshua basically says, you know, man up to this. Get this done. Don't ask for more territory. And so begins this kind of story of, of the Ephraimites kind of being troublesome. All right, sorry to take so long, but I thought we'd just go back in time a little bit and think about why the hill country of Ephraim is always referred to. Anyway, this man's name was Micah, and he said to his mother, and now there's obviously a story before this, we learn about it, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you on which you put a curse, and I heard it even saying in my ears, here's the silver with me, I took it. Why do you think he did that? Why is he confessing all of a sudden?
The curse?
I think potentially, yeah. Already we're seeing a little bit of superstition, and maybe just his mom uttering the curse was enough for him to start confessing. And then, so his mother said, maybe you'd be blessed by, remember Yahweh, capital Lord there is Yahweh. So in return, the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, his mother said, I've wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to Jehovah, to the Lord, for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. So apparently, they're both silver, apparently, because he took it to the silversmith. But one is one that's chipped away and carved and all, and the other is molded. And I don't know the difference. But remember that, because when the Danites come through, the Danites come through, they don't take both of them. They only take one of them. Of course, by that time, there's an ephod and idols and a bunch of other stuff, but they only take the carved image. And I don't know why. Maybe it's more valuable. Maybe it's bigger. One theory is the molded image is maybe just a base. It's not really the main thing. I don't know. But anyway, there are two things made, and therefore I'll return it to you. Thus he returned the silver to his mother. She took 200 shekels of silver, gave them to the silversmith, and he made a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. But that wasn't enough, so Micah begins to build Disney World here. So it's not enough just to have a fancy thing. He ends up making a kind of a museum, a tourist stop, you know. And I'm remembering all those, reptile houses on the road on old U.S. 41 when I was a kid, you know. But you could stop and somebody on the side of the road had decided to make an attraction, you know what I mean? And they had something, snakes or, I don't know, whatever. They had velvet towels of Elvis Presley or anyway, things that, you know, they could sell to people who came through. Anyway, so he does that. He makes a shrine. He made an ephod. Y'all know what an ephod is?
Nice hat.
It's not a hat.
I mean, not the hat.
A chest
piece.
Like a vest. It's the priest's garment, and it's decorated. Probably was fancy. And notice that she had 1,100 pieces of silver, but she only spent 200 on the idols. So I'm guessing, I mean, on the carved and molten images. So I'm guessing some of that money went into these other, you know, decorations. Y'all ever stop to see the thing on the way out to Arizona? You ever, you know what I'm talking about? Mike does. The signs start when you, anyways, some little families, you know, put a big, anyway, that, you know, I have to keep thinking about that. Because you'll see here, he seems like he's advertising this for the whole area. And that's interesting, though, what's involved in that. And he consecrated one of his sons who became a priest. Now, what tribe do you think his sons were? Wild guess.
Ephraim.
Yeah, good guess. He's from Ephraim. He's in the, at least in the hill country. And later he seems to be pleased that a Levite could actually be added to his menagerie, you know. But anyway, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did right in his own eyes. And I think I've mentioned this before, but the word what was is interpolated. So there's, instead of, I think sometimes we read that and think that everyone had their own ethical system, that they'd worked really hard to develop a value system that they lived by. I don't think that's the implication. I think it's just whatever somebody did, they figured it was right. It's more like instead of thinking hard about some alternate ethical value system besides the Ten Commandments and the law of God, they just did whatever they wanted to, and they thought of it as being right. I think that's maybe another way to think of it. All right, that brings us to verse 7, other side of the page here. Where's my pointer? There was. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. Remember I told you that Bethlehem was going to show up to this. Of the family of Judah, okay, he was a Levite and was staying there. So some people are troubled by that, and that is, but I think it just means he was a Levite assigned to one of the cities of Judah, Bethlehem in particular. And he was staying there in Bethlehem. And the man departed from Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. You know the implication of that, right? There must be something better, right? He's going to go find a better place. He came to the mountains of Ephraim, there it is again, to the house of Micah, and as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? So he said to him, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to stay. This just almost sounds like a children's storybook, right? He was wandering with his back knapsack over his shoulder and so on. Anyway, so the fact that he was a Levite, that attracted Micah. He said, dwell with me, be a father and a priest to me. Interesting to me that does he look like a fatherly figure, you know, being a young man? I don't quite get that, but I guess his credentials as a priest would be good. Or maybe Micah was just real young himself. I don't know. Anyway, be a father and a priest to me. I'll give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the Levite. I'm not sure it was his business to do that, but he did it. And the young man became his priest, again, young man, and he lived in the house of Micah. And Micah said, now I know that Yahweh, the Lord, will be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest. It's very likely we know the man's name because later in the story, I wish I had a quick way to get back and forth. Later in the story, in chapter 18, in fact, at the very end, I'll skip ahead to that. You'll notice here that it says right here, the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. Notice only the carved image. And the Jonathan, that must have been the guy's name, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, which could be Moses. There's a long history about the textual evidence for that. But Gershom was one of the sons of Moses. That's not in question. So it could be that this was Jonathan, or Jehonathan is another way his name might be pronounced. He could be like a grandson, great-grandson, you know, at least in the lineage of Moses from the son Gershom. And that makes a lot of sense. So he was a Levite. That fits. So it's very likely this guy, this young man who's not named in chapter 17, is actually a descendant of Moses, and his name is Jonathan. Okay. Point, questions about that? All right. Time to wake up. Thanks for coming. We have a group activity now. I'd like you to just very quickly, maybe somebody in your group get a pencil and piece of paper and write down all the decisions that have been made so far in the story. And think about how those decisions were made. All right? I'll give you a start. Here's a hint. The first decision was the guy decided to steal his mother's money, right? So that'd be an example. So go from there, and I'll break everybody into groups now, and I'm going to stop sharing. And so you ever got the question? List all the decisions and quickly the basis. We're only going to do this for 2 or 3 minutes, okay? Let's go with maybe 4 rooms. Nope, let's go 5. That's 3 to 4. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Go.
Hello.
Hello.
So decisions. Decision time.
Decision making time. Well, one, he chose to be, to sell himself out. You know, I mean, can we do that? Like, can you just like start taking money to be somebody's priest for hire? He became a priest for hire.
Okay. And I think too, even before he, before he did that too, just what Marty suggested, the decision to even leave and go seek his fortune elsewhere.
Find a better job.
Yeah.
Better location. We've got Micah, who stole from his mom, who gave it back to his mom. His mom, who decided that she should make an idol.
What'd you say, Aaron? Did you say something?
Well, it says, the mother says, I dedicated the silver to the Lord. So that was a decision that she made. Why? And then she said, I will restore it.
Yeah. And then it was her decision to make an idol with it.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's
so far.
Why did he make an ephod? I mean, that's a decision.
Like, pretty much everything on here is just because he wanted to. Like, every decision on here is.
And ordained one of his sons. Why did he ordain one of his sons? That was a decision.
I mean, there is some amount of
go ahead. I'm sorry.
There is some amount of, like, I think God wants me to do this, but I think it's really just because that's what I wanted to do.
Well, the next line was, everyone did what was right in his own mind.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we say this all the time, but it's just so, what did Eric say? Never inquired of, exactly, yeah. They had the law, we have the law, but oftentimes it's what makes me feel good or what would I enjoy instead of what has God said for me to do.
Okay. See, it's almost over. Any more, Teresa?
No.
Even the priest goes off just to.
Is the priest?
The mountains in Ephraim again. Something about.
You know, so I explained the assignment, everything. She finally just said, Mr. Marty, I don't know how to do this. I said, you just hold on, it will happen to you. So,
yeah.
But actually, there is a way to eject yourself, as James did. So
yeah, I just did
it. All right, quickly now. I hope I'm still sharing, but just list some of the decisions. Call them out, and maybe just add a sentence or a phrase that says why did they decide to do that? What? Give me a decision. Start with the one I gave you, which is decide to steal the silver. What was the reason for that? What motivated that? I know we're speculating, but I think it's not too hard.
Just greed.
Yeah, he just wanted it, right? His mom had it. I don't guess it was going to be his mom would approve of it. Obviously, she cursed whoever did it, all right? All right, keep going. What else did you – what are some other decisions? Just call them out.
Mom decides to make idols.
Yeah, after he returns the money. Yeah. Others, what's some others?
Mom decided to utter the curse.
Yeah, the curse was a decision. Why was she motivated to do that, you think?
Try to get her money back and get revenge.
That's exactly right. What's God for if you can't call on him when you're in trouble, right? And somebody steals something from you. All right? What's another one?
Micah confessed.
Yes. He returned the silver, in fact. Did more. Why do you think he did that?
Because of the curse.
Probably likely. It was clear. He said, I heard what you said, and here it is. I'm giving it back, you know. All right, what's another one? I think we already covered. His mom decides to reverse the curse and bless the thief, right? And then we already mentioned dedicate the silver. What do you think was the reasoning behind that? Why dedicate it to Yahweh, as she says she's going to do?
Nullify the curse.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Maybe that's right, Cherry. Could be that this would pay God off, so, you know, don't carry out what I asked you to do before. I was a little bit mixed up. And maybe it's some idea that it would honor him. What other decisions?
He consecrated his son. Are we there yet?
That's right. Maybe idols, set up a shrine, set up a son as a priest. Those are all religious activities. You might think that's a good thing. What do you think the motive was behind all that? Mating idols, setting up shrines, setting the son as a priest?
To have God, or to feel that God is with him?
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe, maybe that's right. It seemed like I missed the phrase when we were reading it. I should have found it. It was going to be like a shrine for the whole land. There's some phrase that indicates that he wanted to kind of serve as a kind of a famous place maybe for everybody to come to. Maybe we'll get to that phrase in a minute, I guess.
It was right in their own eyes.
That's right. But it was right in their own eyes because it served their purpose, right, in each case. Not because it was difficult, but God said do it and you do it anyway, and if you don't see how it will benefit you, but rather how will it benefit you in each case. And finally, recruit the Levite. And you notice he's almost like thrilled at that because now he can have the priest he wanted, the shrine he wanted, the images and all that, the religion that he wanted, but he has this kind of a cover story of legitimacy, right? Because it indicates he knew that his own son was not a legitimate priest, but now this Levite gives him some kind of a cover story for being legitimate. Okay. You kind of sense what's going on in the story. Yeah.
I was going to say, and the Levite looks like he probably always wanted to be a priest, and now he gets his opportunity.
Oh, man, does he land on his feet, right? I mean, he's got a nice salary. He's got clothing. He's got his food taken care of. He's kind of in charge of things there. And so he's running this tourist, attraction there in the hill country of Ephraim. It's obviously on the way. It's on the main road, right? Because the Danites come through there. The five men do on their way. So we'll see that later. And so he took the job as a priest, obviously, and he knew that was not the right kind of worship if he was a Levite of any kind to do that, and yet he took that position in that in a really idolatrous situation. Now, you know, the question that's always nagging at us is, well, who's the bad guy here, and who's the good guy? I mean, I want this story to be simple, right? You know what I'm saying? Well, so whose example do I follow? What am I supposed to learn from this? Yeah, I don't know.
There's no good guys.
There's no nougat. Yeah. It's just, it really, I mean, if you look at some of the archaeological finds and stuff, it really gives you an explanation of the things that they find, the mindset, the mixing together of Yahweh, of Bel, Asherah, all wrapped up in together. And their mind is, hey, if I can actually get a Levite, I've reached that next level, but, this is what you find. This is the attitude of all those people.
Right. So, still a question. What do we learn? Anyway, all right. So, I just want to, before we get to the Danites, who have not appeared in the story yet, I just want to remind you how well they did in taking their own territory and why they're on the run or on the move here to find another place. Back in chapter 1, we read that the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. Does that sound familiar? Right? They're brothers of the Ephraimites, I guess, that way. For they would not allow them to come down into the valley. So that's one thing. But we're going to see a little description, a little different description when we get back to the story in a minute. But I just want to also go back into Joshua and read what's written there in Joshua. Of course, written after the time of Joshua, but describing the casting of lots and the assignment of territory. And I'm not going to read all these cities, but I will. The seventh lot came out for the tribe of the children of Dan, according to their families. And their territory was Zorah and Eshtaol. That's important. We'll hear about those in this story, right? And then a bunch of other cities, including cities of the Philistines, like Ekron, for example. We recognize that one. And then, and the border of the children of Dan went beyond these. And another translation of that, perhaps a better one, is went from them. Right? Mean that their border kind of went away from them. They didn't have them. Because, in the other translations, therefore, the children of Dan went up to fight against Leshem, which maybe is Laish, seems like it is in the context here. And they took it, and they struck it with the edge of the sword, took possession of it, and dwelt in it. And they called Leshem, as maybe Laish, Dan, after the name of Dan their father. This is the inheritance of the children of Dan. Okay. So you get the story there. And I think that's Joshua's version of it. And that is they didn't take the land they should have. They did get a lot assigned to them. They just couldn't take possession of it. And therefore they went up to this other place, Leshem, which most people think is probably Laish up there. I'll just mention another couple of things. People try to date the story by this migration of the Danites. One interesting thing in the story and poem of Deborah and Barak is that they mentioned Dan stayed by his ships, suggesting that there was a seacoast involved with Dan. That would suggest they're in the south still, bordering on the Mediterranean and not way up in the north east, you know, where they're not on the seacoast. That's one idea. Another thing that might date the story is you remember our friend Jabin, who was a Canaanite up there in the north in the area around Beth. Is it Beth Shan? Danny, help me with that. Is that right?
It's the other side of Beth Shan.
It was Hazor. And that would be up farther north. And this movement of the Danites, especially with 600 men and all that, might have been more difficult if he was controlling that area. So that would put it earlier, maybe. Don't know. But some idea that it's before the time of Barak. I don't know. Just some interesting things to think about. So anyway, starting chapter 18. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of Danites was seeking, inheritance to dwell in, for until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. Now, that term can be used to mean that they hadn't cast the lots yet, but that's not what it means. We read in Joshua that they did that. What that means is they hadn't gotten it yet, so they could pass it down. And notice the key word here is their inheritance. The idea that something they would have that they could pass down among the tribes. They didn't have it, that they could pass it down. And that may be the significance of the word fallen. I don't know. Anyway, they didn't have it. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor, and there's our cities again, Zorah and Eshtaol, and we saw those on the map, to spy out the land and search it. And they said to them, go search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. You see, so I just get the impression he's got an amusement park. People can stop by. They can worship, you know, see his stuff. While they were there, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. Now, that's interesting. I don't think they knew him before. It's possible they just recognized that he didn't have the accent of the Ephraimites. Remember how the accent came into another story? Remember that? So maybe he's just saying, wait, you're not from around here. Where are you from? So they turned and said, who brought you here? What are you doing here? What do you have here? And so he told them, thus and so Micah did for me. He's hired me. I've become his priest. So they said to him, oh, priest. Oh, okay. Well, how about putting that ephod on and asking for some help? And so they said, please inquire of God. Notice not Yahweh, but Elohim, that we may know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous. And so the priest apparently did that, and he said, go in peace. The presence of Yahweh will be with you on your way. Did he have that revelation from Jehovah? Who knows?
I don't even think that was an answer.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, That's a good point. That's a real good point. He doesn't say you're going to be successful. He just says God's going to be around you when you're going. Yeah.
Normally, when you listen, when God would give someone, it was a little bit more specific. That could be, yay. I mean, it's something that could be uttered. And you really, it's like, well, yeah. That's not an answer.
They could have gotten killed, and he could say, yeah, I guess the Lord was with you.
That's right. Exactly.
Care about him in the way he wanted to. So the five men departed and went to Laish. And they saw the people who were there, how they dwelt in safety, in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, which suggests to me that they just had a nice place to live. It was maybe isolated enough that they weren't under threat. It was peaceful. They didn't have any worries about food to eat and so on. And I just included a picture that I took of my kids up in the area of Laish. And just take a look at the scenery there. It reminded me of North Georgia. It's a really nice place. I'm not sure that they dwelt right by that waterfall. That's actually a park you can go through. But still, it is kind of a lot of greenery and mountain hills. Looks like the Appalachians in a lot of ways. It's a nice area. And apparently far enough from any of the big cities, there were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. That means they could do whatever they wanted to, and no one would punish them. And they were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. Some people think that this reference to Sidon means that maybe these were immigrants from Sidon, but they were so far away that they weren't going to get any help from Sidon, which is way over on the coast, you know, the Mediterranean coast way on the west. Anyway, the spies came back to their brethren Zora and Eshtaol, and their brethren said to them, well, what's your report? Their brethren said to them, what's your report? So they said, arise and go up against them, for we have seen the land. It's indeed very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. And when you go, you'll come to a secure people and a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there's no lack of anything that is on the earth. Doesn't that sound like a great place to live? Yeah. I do remember actually seeing fig trees everywhere, like bushes, and, you know, and figs on them, big figs everywhere. But I'm sure it's different today. I mean, anyway, so 600 men of the family of the Danites, and I don't think that's all the Danites, obviously, but they do have their wives and children with them. We'll see that later. But I don't think that's the entire tribe. I think we ended up with parts of Dan in both places, perhaps. Went from there, from Zora and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war. They went up and encamped in Kiriath-Jearim, which means city of forests, in Judah. And now this is interesting. I'll test your memory here. Therefore, they call that place Mahane Dan to this day. Does anybody remember where that's come up once before in our study of Judges? This is a trivia test. Nikki's going to say it, I think.
1325.
Yeah, what's that story about?
I don't know. It's at the bottom of your screen right there.
I know that.
That's where the Spirit of the Lord began to stir.
For who?
Samson.
Yes, that's right. So remember, Samson's a Danite, and for some reason that's mentioned there. Now, what's interesting is, remember, Samson's way later in the whole thing. We don't know why that place is called the Camp of Dan. Why is it called that? Now we know it's because when those 600 soldiers and their families came through, they camped near, actually behind, it says there, to Kiriath-Jearim, and they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim. So they must have stayed there long enough for it to get a name. So it's called the Camp of Dan. It's kind of identical to Kiriath-Jearim or Kirjath-Jearim. Anyway, they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. So just an interesting connection to later on when that same location is referred to in the story of Samson. Okay, so the five men who are leading the way, I'm assuming, because they've been there before, they know the way to Laish. And it's kind of the one that encouraged everybody to go take it. The five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to the brethren, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, carved image, a molded image? Now, therefore, consider what you should do. That's interesting that they didn't say what they should do, but they just said, you kind of know what you should do, I think. So they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. And the 600 armed men, armed with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. You get the picture there? these five guys go back into the house, but then there are these 600 soldiers that kind of surround the front of the house. So you can kind of see that's a threatening formation, if you want to say it that way. The five men who had gone to spy the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. Now, it seemed like I didn't remember that they took that, because later it doesn't show up. So I was wrong about that. I remember it from the later thing. Okay, question mark. We'll see what happens. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household items, and the molded image, the priest said to them, "What?" Remember that word. We're going to come back to that. What are you doing? And I in this case, I left the italicized interpolated words. You'll know in translations when words are in italics, it doesn't mean shout them. It means that they are not in the original text, and the translators have stuck those English words in so that it makes a little bit more sense. But I usually delete all that because it's distracting. But this one I left in there. And over here too, you'll find the same word, what, and then ALU is kind of like, you got to put something in there because there's just what doesn't make sense. So I think we're going to see that in here. There's two other places. Actually, this one is a quote of that one, but anyway. And they said to him, "Be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. It's better for you to be a priest to. Is it better to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" So the priest's heart was glad. I mean, you know, he's gotten a promotion here. Never mind whatever commitments he's made in the past. Never mind if he's doing the right thing. Never mind the Danites are doing the right thing and what they're doing. But he's going to go with them. And he took the ephod, the household items. There it is right there. And the carved image. And he took his place. So the other one seems to have stayed behind. I don't know why. That was it. And you'll see that later too. And they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. Now, why would they put all the slow people in front of the group as they travel? Why would they put the animals and the kids and everybody in front as they're traveling?
Because trouble's going to come from behind?
That's right. They anticipate that perhaps Micah might be able to muster some support and come after them, right? And so what they did was they put the weaker people in the front and left the soldiers and the military protection behind as they traveled. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. When they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. So apparently he had enough friends and supporters to go after them. And they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" So he said to them, "You've taken my gods away, which I made, and the priest, and you've gone away. Now what more do I have?" Like, he invested, you know, a lot in that shrine and that priest and all that. "How can you say to me, what ails you?" Just a little bit more, and I don't know Hebrew at all. I just want you, this is an interesting thing you should know. And that is that I guess maybe a lot of languages don't, but Hebrew doesn't have a thing called a question mark. I mean, they just don't have a question mark. I guess a lot of languages don't. But they have a thing called an interrogative particle, which is a word, which means if you start with this word, then what follows is a question. And that word is just generally translated what, usually. But some it can be how or why or whatever. But it's just a little short word called ma or ma that you say at the beginning of a sentence. And that means I'm about to ask a question, like, what are you doing? And they just basically say what. Or their ma, right? And then not what ails you, but ma, you've gathered such a company, or ma, you know, what are you doing kind of thing. And that word is interesting because it's the word that it shows up some other times, which I think you're familiar with. When the children of Israel came out and they saw this white stuff on the ground in the time of Moses, they said, ma.
What is it?
And it didn't say, what is it? They just said, what? They said, question mark. I don't know what the word would be, right? And, of course, then the word manna became the name for that stuff that was on the ground. And later, when Moses was telling in Deuteronomy chapter 6, was telling children of Israel, you know, here's a bunch of laws. There's a lot of them, and they're really complicated. You need to be diligent to learn them and keep them and everything. Now, when the day comes that your children say, math, law, what they're saying is, what is it with all these laws, you know? And then he says, you're going to say to them and explain to them how God rescued you and this is for your good and all that. And then later, too, you remember the story when Joshua collected those stones and they made a shrine. And he said, when your children ask you, ma, stones, or, you know, ma, stones, they're saying, what are these stones? That's kind of the idea. So that's kind of an interesting word that shows up at other times, and you may recognize those incidents as well. Anyway, what? It's a simple, really just a syllable that represents an exclamation, a question mark, sorry, question mark. Anyway, am I putting you all to sleep with all this stuff? I don't know. Sorry. Anyway, the children of Dan said, don't let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household. So they threatened him. He said, you're not going to win. Look around. Think about it. And the children of Dan went their way. And when Micah saw they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. So there's the end of that part of the story. All right. And we're almost done. So we'll travel. Yeah, yeah, Teresa, or who said that? Yeah.
The Levi, or the priest for hire, was he actually Micah's son, or was he just saying he was like a son to him?
That's right. He was just like a, no, he's actually like a father to him, the way he told the story. So Micah said, you be my priest, and you be my father, you know, and you'll have all this honor, and I'll support you and everything. And so anyway, I think that's the idea.
Okay.
Maybe father in the way the Catholics use it.
Yeah, good point. Exactly like that. In fact, look down here. He was then going to go become a father and a priest to the whole tribe, right?
Right.
So, boy, that's a way better position, right, than just one man and maybe just the neighborhood in the mountains of Ephraim.
Yeah. But first he consecrated his son, and then the Levite came along. And he consecrated him over his son.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so that is kind of confusing. Yeah, it was his son at first, but then I don't know what happened to his son. The poor guy lost his job when the Levite shows up. So I don't know. Maybe he went somewhere else looking for a better preaching position. I don't know. But anyway. Okay. So the Danites, they're on their way. They got their stuff. Everything's fine. You know, Micah and his house, they were intimidated away. And anyway, so they took the things that Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure. Mentioned again, it just, I don't know, you notice how it's emphasizing these people are kind of defenseless and they seem like they're just comfortable, but they're victims in a way. And they struck them with the edge of the sword and they burned the city with fire and there was no deliverer. And that's not the same word as judge, even though we've used the term English word deliver. That's a different word. I thought it might be the same, but it isn't. There was just no one to rescue them. There was no one to make things right. Because, as we read before, it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. They had no friends, nobody that was close enough that would come to their rescue. And it was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. And that was interesting to me because if you turn that around, it's Rehoboth, right? And there's a Rehoboth around here. And the boys joked that when Mary's funeral, when we had her funeral, we didn't have enough room in the funeral area, in the funeral home. So we rented the big auditorium across the street at the Rehoboth Baptist Church. And Rehoboth means, you know what Beth means, right? Beth is house. And Rehoboth means a house of a broad place, a room, or it could be a street, a broad street. But anyway, Beth Rehob, or however you say it, is a house of a broad place. So anyway, so they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. And they called the name of the city Dan after the name of Dan, their father, who was born to Israel. That is Jacob, of course. However, the name of the city was formerly Laish. The children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. Notice, I don't know what happened to the molten image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and some texts, ancient texts say Moses. there's even a theory that some of the way later scribes, thinking of the other Manasseh, Manasseh the son of, what, Hezekiah, is that right? Who was such a terrible king, that they put that in place because there's no way they would want to say, let this, let it be known that this Jonathan was any way related to Moses. I think that's kind of a fairy tale, but anyway, it is possibly that he was the grandson or great-great-great-grandson of Moses or something. And his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. And boy, that's a puzzling phrase. It probably does not refer to the Assyrian captivity. It's probably a more localized conquest that occurred later. It may be even during the later time of the Judges, but who knows? But there's some, whoever's writing this already knows about the captivity. And remember that this next phrase kind of helps us date the book. All the time that the house of God was at Shiloh, right? Suggesting that it's not at Shiloh anymore. And you remember it left Shiloh, sons of Eli took it into battle. It got captured by the Philistines. And guess where it ended up? Anybody know where it ended up after it made the rounds of the Philistine temples? And where did it end up? I know Jerusalem in David's time, but before that, the last stop before David's time.
Obed-Edom.
Well, that was one of the stops. Well, what was the city?
Bethshan, wasn't it?
It was Kiriath-Jearim. Yeah. It's our city. It's where the camp of Dan is. It's also in this story, too, so kind of an interesting coincidence. But anyway, the point is, wherever this captivity was, whenever it was sometime, you know, where I think during the time of this author who is dated to some extent after the house of God being in Shiloh. And you remember there was an earlier reference, and I forgot what it is right now, that says it was after that had occurred. So anyway, there's that. Okay, I'm pretty well done. I just want to maybe wrap this up with thinking about some of the decisions that were made. Think about, I want to do it here. Here's an example decision. Make idols in a shrine. I wonder what possible value system that would reflect. I feel like I've gone too fast. Anybody want to say anything else about the details of the story? Details that you noted as we went through?
I did have a question.
Okay, great.
Just, Marty, do you know if they were punished for killing that quiet city that wasn't bothering anybody? Do you know anything else about the story?
No, unless this reference right here has to do with the fact that they eventually lost it, you know, where it says the captivity of the land. I don't know what land that would be or what captivity it would be if it's not the Assyrian. But obviously all of the Israelites eventually were judged. But it does not appear that in this generation or several generations there was any punishment at all. You notice that? Because it says that the man's sons and his sons, right? Where is it? They were the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity. So it seems like it was several generations. So the answer is no, I think. No evidence.
Well, was it to drive them out anyway?
What's that?
That weren't they in the land of Canaan, and they were supposed to drive out?
Yeah, sure. So maybe you could interpret their getting rid of the people of Laish as a kind of a part of their job. Although it doesn't appear, it looks like that land was not part of anybody's inheritance, right? It wasn't within their borders, and they just went farther north. But I don't know what to make of that. Somebody help me out. I'm floundering with this answer.
Well, I don't have an answer for that, but I am curious about normally when they were going to take something, they were always, the people in the land were always bigger, stronger, and they were scared. And they, you know, God help us. But this was like, we don't need God. We're strong enough because they're weak.
Yeah.
And we can actually take them. So they're not thinking about God at all in this. They're thinking about their own might. And not only their own might, but the fact that the people can't fight back. So more of a cowardly kind of.
Good. And it's actually in contrast to the fact that why were they up there anyways? They couldn't do the job God gave them to do in the land that was given to them as part of the ancient landmarks that Jehovah had set, you know.
Dan was where Jeroboam, one of the places Jeroboam put up a calf for worship. And actually the the location is now available. It's, archaeology has turned it up so that you can actually visit it.
So not a good future there, but who knows. But Teresa, I think there's a bigger question behind your question, which is, where is God in all this? Why is he letting all this evil happen? Does that bother you guys? And, you know, so I'm still asking the question, who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Why isn't God taking care of this? Why is he letting all this happen? That's a disturbing thing about the book of Judges. And if you remember that picture, they put very disturbing, you know, over the story that's going to follow. And I think we may want to have a simple view that if you do bad, God punishes you right away. And if you do good, God protects you. And that's just not quite the case. And you see a situation here where it looks like their generations are passing and you know, it just seems to be getting worse and worse. So let's just talk about, get through this one here. Here's an example decision, and I'm going to project a little bit here. Why would he do that? I think he just wanted to do it. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that, it may have been, you can think a lot of things. Like, is it too inconvenient to try to follow the law of Moses? It's so complicated. He'd be more like the folks around him. He had quite a bit of silver. If you go on tours around the world, a lot of the places you visit are temples, right? Because there's artwork and gold and silver and things that are, you know, worth seeing. And so, it was just a thing that kind of would look like a successful thing to do. I don't really know why he would do it, but, and maybe there was a religious thought behind it, but it obviously is, you let James in there again. Looks like he bailed out again. He's back. All right. So, and then recruiting the priest, I think that, you know, I don't, back to the idols and shrine, I don't think anybody really would object to that in the neighborhood. If you were faithful to God, you would, but you'd not be very popular. If you stood up and said, wait a minute, what are you doing here? This isn't the right thing to do. And Shiloh is not too far away. That's the right. And what is this with the idols and what's it with the non-Levite priest and a lot of things like that? But nobody did that because it obviously probably made them feel okay. It made them feel good to have that there. And so he recruited the priest, which was kind of an improvement, and that benefited him. And that was actually a fair transaction too, because I give you something, you give me something, and it's a fair transaction. Nobody gets hurt. Everybody benefits, and I give you enough to, you know, buy what I need, and you don't get more than you need perhaps. But anyway, we have a fair transaction. And then why would you accept the job as a priest? I think he just did what benefited him the most, right? And by the way, did it hurt anybody that he took that job as the priest? I mean, he wasn't robbing the money from the guy. And I doubt if anybody, you know, nobody was the worse off for that.
Maybe his son, if he kicked him out of a job.
Well, that's true. I forgot the son who got fired. Right. But yes, that's right. But in general, I don't want to hurt anybody. You know, I just took the job and, you know, it benefits me the most and it's okay if I don't hurt anybody. But you know, the story gets darker after that. And that is when they come and steal the idols. They say, you know, I just want these and it benefits me and I don't want to hurt you. Don't make me hurt you, but I will if I have to. Right. And you see, there's kind of this, yeah, I just do what I want to do. I hope nobody gets hurt, but if they do, well, I mean, I just wanted to do it. And so that's what happened. And then of course, when they get to Laish, what's the motive there? You just do what you want, no matter what's going on, no matter whom it hurts, right? As long as no one stronger can stop you, which is kind of what we saw in this part of the story here, is they would have had to do something violent if there had been a counterattack, but there wasn't. But here in Laish, they didn't negotiate. There's no concern at all about the benefit of another person.
Might makes right all the way through there in that last section.
That's right. And my point is that I'm not sure I see much difference when you start doing what makes you feel good. I'm not sure I see much difference, and it's kind of a natural progression right on down to, I don't know if it's hurting anybody or not, but I just want to do it, right? And I don't know why. I think of situations where people decide to get a divorce and somehow or another they're going to negotiate and it's going to be a fair transaction. And I hope the kids don't get hurt or something like that. But in the end, it doesn't matter. It's a violent thing. People are hurt. When you start with a value system that's just built around what makes you feel good, this is where you end up.
Yeah.
You end up just doing what you want to do. And if somebody can stop you, they will. But if they can't, then you got it. You're done. And so I guess I would say this kind of as a conclusion. I don't think any value system apart from God's instruction can be consistently applied by limited man. If we keep going around trying to figure out, okay, let's make sure no one gets hurt in any of these things we're doing, and let's just try to do what's best and makes everybody feel the best, it's just not going to work. We're too limited. You understand what I mean? We're not smart enough to know what will eventually hurt somebody or not, or what's fair transaction or whatever. We just end up doing what we want to do, especially if God's not around to step in some immediate way to stop us in what we're doing. And another way to say it is any self-directed system will lead to a might makes right and a lawlessness and an anarchy. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see it in worse form in the next story. Yeah, Jane, go ahead.
No. I'm just agreeing with you. When there's no standard outside of yourself to appeal to, this is what you get. And that's what you see in the story you just read at the end. No one could appeal to anything while somebody, what they were doing was wrong.
Right.
There's just nothing to hold on to.
Right. And of course, we keep thinking of the phrase, every man did right in his own eyes. I think that's what this is. It's just that. And all I'm trying to say is sometimes in our culture, there's a sense of, yeah, you do your thing, I'll do mine, don't mess with me, as long as nobody gets hurt, as if there was some real line you could draw like that. There isn't one. There isn't one, and we're not smart enough to find it, even if there was one. There's some kind of sense of right that's a brighter, more wise, more eternal than just whether somebody that I can figure out gets hurt or not, and I think that's the idea. And, of course, you know the phrase, we're going to hear it again at the end of the book. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did right in his own eyes, and I think that's what this epilogue is about. And you have to mourn a fear for a culture that begins this process of losing any sense of absolute value and only does things that seem to be right or that benefit each person. Okay.
But they were still claiming to believe in God.
And that's the odd thing.
Follow God's will.
Thank you. And the trappings too, using the word Yahweh, hiring a Levite, those kind of things, those are still there. And yet there's really no acknowledgement of God's law or his presence or anything.
The form of godliness, but denying its power.
Power thereon, yeah.
I have a question.
Oh, no.
Right. And I mean, it may not be answerable. I don't know. I mean, it seems like there are bits and pieces of knowledge of God, God's word. I mean, he thinks it would be better to have a Levite as a priest. He thinks I should have a priest.
Why a priest at all? Yeah, good.
Yeah, like we should worship something. We should call it Jehovah. Like, there's those bits. So, is it a case of having just a little bit of knowledge and just completely misusing it, or having enough knowledge but just completely, turning a blind eye to what's actually requested by God?
So I always think of this, and I think I read it somewhere, is there's always a little bit of ignorance in rebellion, and there's always a little bit of rebellion in ignorance. And I think you get a little bit of both of those, right? I mean, if you ignore the law of God long enough, you finally don't know it. You just don't know it. And if you don't know it and are not interested in finding out, there's a kind of rebellion in staying in that ignorance too. But you're right, there's enough of a memory, I guess. You know, you can see some traces of it in the idea of worship and the use of the word. But I wonder if even in our culture, I hear words used, like especially taking the Lord's name in vain and things. It's still in our language, but it isn't in our thoughts. It's odd how that works.
The thing I noticed almost each time they mentioned Jehovah, it was always in response to when something good happened.
Mm.
It was never something bad. So if I'm thinking that's where God's blessing me, so something good happens, that means he's on my side. So, we have more of that, or still have a lot of that. And that idea of things are working out the way I believe they should be worked, then God is pleased with it. Yeah, yeah. Even if it is, like you mentioned, marriage, breakup. But I'm happy. God wants me to be happy. So there's still that idea.
Yeah. Yeah, there's and there's a reference to God. There's not any reference to the law or anything that would be a kind of a source of authority or a contradiction to what I want to do in the story.
Yeah. Hey, Marty.
Yeah, please.
In chapter 17, verse 13.
Yeah.
For me, it wraps it up. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levi as a priest."
With his idols. I mean, is that a little bit kind of crazy that he said that? Yeah, that's good.
The Levites were actually the ones who were supposed to teach the law.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, he's obviously not in a position to preach much against idols where he is there.
Yeah. But if I get enough of God, the things God likes, it's his favor. It makes him do favorable things to me when I get enough of his things as a part of my life, whether it's this case a Levite or, we can use the same things today. I took the Lord's Supper. He should be pleased with me and bless me because I've done these things that in turn he rewards me in some way.
So as a preview, I would just say, is it often the case that sometimes we can, we hear this argument, we can disagree about religious things, but as long as we're good moral people, right? That's the main thing that matters. Well, we're about to go into chapter 19 and see how that works out.
How do you define moral?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. How can you abandon any kind of religious truth and then somehow or another pretend that there's some moral restraint of some kind? And that's what I think happens next in the next story. Again, in somewhat the same area. It's around Bethlehem where part of it occurs and in Benjamin, the nearby city. So, all right, I'm done. I should have stopped sharing a while ago, but so the folks can see each other better. All right.
Thanks, Marty.
Yeah.
Marty, you got any more of the pictures from up there?
I do have a lot. But in fact, I have one of that site of Dan that Sewell was making reference to.
Where the golden calf was, yeah.
Yeah, but people don't want to see pictures. I do have one which I meant to have for the Gideon lesson where Beth and Daniel are, kneeling down at the Herod Springs and,
David Williams has a good picture of that too from his
trip.
I'll tell you, Dan, one of the things that Farrell kind of pointed out, I mean, where you're there, where the altar and all that was, you look out and it's kind of a valley, and that's where the Assyrians come marching in.
Is that right?
Yeah. So you can picture that valley, just that of those Assyrians coming in to take that region.
Yeah, is that up the valley from the south?
Or it's to the north of Dan.
North, okay, yeah.
Because they would have come from the north, but there's a valley that leads right into Dan. And I mean, it's the headwaters of the Jordan River.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess it's Mount Hermon that the waters come down from here.
And, you got Mount Hermon on one side, 10,000 feet. You got Mount Lebanon on the other side at 11,000 feet. Which is probably why the folks in Sidon couldn't come across that mountain to help, their folks there because they had a big mountain to go over.